distraction and disrupting your practice. Method: becoming familiar with meditative joy through continued practice until the excitement fades, replaced by tranquility and equanimity. Mastery: consistently evoking mental and physical pliancy, accompanied by profound tranquility and equanimity. Stage 10. Tranquility and equanimity. You enter stage 10 with all the qualities of shamatha: effortlessly stable attention, mindfulness, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. At first, these qualities immediately fade after the meditation has ended. But as you continue to practice, they persist longer and longer between meditation sessions. Eventually, they become the normal condition of the mind. Because the characteristics of shamatha never disappear entirely, whenever you sit on the cushion, you quickly regain a fully developed meditative state. You have mastered stage 10 when the qualities of shamatha persist for many hours after you rise from the cushion. Once stage 10 is mastered, the mind is described as unsurpassable. Milestone 4. Persistence of the mental qualities of an adept. When you have mastered stage 10, the many positive mental qualities you experience during meditation are strongly present, even between meditation sessions, so your daily life is imbued with effortlessly stable attention, mindfulness, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. This is the fourth and final milestone, and marks the culmination of an adept meditator's training. Cultivating the right attitude and setting clear intentions. We naturally tend to think of ourselves as the agent responsible for producing results through will and effort. Certain words we can't avoid using when we talk about meditation, such as achieve and master, only reinforce this idea. We often believe we should be in control, the masters of our own minds. But that belief only creates problems for your practice. It will lead you to try to willfully force the mind into submission. When that inevitably fails, you will tend to get discouraged and blame yourself. This can turn into a habit, unless you realize there is no self in charge of the mind, and therefore nobody to blame. As you continue to meditate, this fact of no self becomes increasingly clear, but you can't afford to wait for that insight. For the sake of making progress, it's best to drop this notion, at least at an intellectual level, as soon as possible. In reality, all we're doing in meditation is forming and holding specific conscious intention, nothing more. In fact, while it may not be obvious, all our achievements originate from intentions. Consider learning to play catch. As a child, you may have wanted to play catch, but at first your arm and hand just didn't move in quite the right way. However, by sustaining the intention to catch the ball after much practice, your arm and hand eventually performed the task whenever you wanted. You don't play catch. Instead, you just intend to catch the ball, and the rest follows. You intend, and the body acts. In exactly the same way, we can use intention to profoundly transform how the mind behaves. Intention, provided it is correctly formulated and sustained, is what creates the causes and conditions for stable attention and mindfulness. Intentions repeatedly sustained over the course of many meditation sessions give rise to frequently repeated mental acts, which eventually become habits of the mind. At every stage, all you really do is patiently and persistently hold your intentions to respond in specific ways to whatever happens during your meditation. Setting and holding the right intentions is what's essential. If your intention is strong, the appropriate responses will occur and the practice will unfold in a very natural and predictable way. Once again, repeatedly sustained intentions lead to repeated mental actions, which become mental habits. The habits of mind that lead to joy, equanimity, and insight. The exquisite simplicity of this process isn't so obvious in the early stages. However, by the time you reach stage 8 and your meditations become completely effortless, it will be clear. While useful, The lists of goals, obstacles, skills, and mastery provided in this discussion so far can obscure just how simple the underlying process really is. Intentions lead to mental actions, and repeated mental actions become mental habits. This simple formula is at the heart of every stage. Therefore, here's a brief recap of the 10 stages, presented in a completely different way that puts the emphasis entirely on how intention works in each stage. Refer to the earlier outline when you need to orient yourself within the context of the stages as a whole, but look at the outline that follows whenever working through the individual stages begins to feel like a struggle. Stage 1. Put all your effort into forming and holding a conscious intention to sit down and meditate for a set period every day, and to practice diligently for the duration of the sit. When your intentions are clear and strong, the appropriate actions naturally follow, and you'll find yourself regularly sitting down to meditate. If this doesn't happen, instead of chastising yourself and trying to force yourself to practice, work on strengthening your motivation and intentions. Stage 2. Willpower can't prevent the mind from forgetting the breath, nor can you force yourself to become aware that the mind is wandering. Instead, just hold the intention to appreciate the aha moment that recognizes mind wandering, while gently but firmly redirecting attention back to the breath. Then, intend to engage with the breath as fully as possible without losing peripheral awareness. In time, the simple actions flowing from these 3 intentions will become mental habits. Periods of mind wandering will become shorter. Periods of attention to the breath will grow longer, and you'll have achieved your goal. Stage 3. Set your intention to invoke introspective attention frequently before you've forgotten the breath or fallen asleep, and make corrections as soon as you notice distractions or dullness. Also, intend to sustain peripheral awareness while engaging with the breath as fully as possible. These 3 intentions and the actions they produce are simply elaborations of those from Stage 2. Once they become habits, you'll rarely forget the breath. Stages 4 through 6. Set and hold the intention to be vigilant so that introspective awareness becomes continuous, and notice and immediately correct for dullness and distraction. These intentions will mature into the highly developed skills of stable attention and mindfulness. You overcome every type of dullness and distraction, achieving both exclusive, single-pointed attention and metacognitive introspective awareness. Stage 7. Everything becomes even simpler. With the conscious intention to continuously guard against dullness and distraction, the mind becomes completely accustomed to effortlessly sustaining attention and mindfulness. Stages 8 through 10. Your intention is simply to keep practicing, using skills that are now completely effortless. In Stage 8, effortlessly sustained exclusive attention produces mental and physical pliancy, pleasure, and joy. In Stage 9, simply abiding in the state of meditative joy causes profound tranquility and equanimity to arise. In Stage 10, just by continuing to practice regularly, the profound joy and happiness, tranquility, and equanimity you experience in meditation persists between meditation sessions, infusing your daily life as well. As with planting seeds, at each stage, you sow the appropriate intentions in the soil of the mind. Water these intentions with the diligence of regular practice and protect them from the destructive pests of procrastination, doubt, desire, aversion, and agitation. These intentions will naturally flower into a specific series of mental events that mature to produce the fruits of your practice. Will a seed sprout more quickly if you keep digging it up and replanting it? No. Therefore, don't let impatience or frustration stop you from practicing or convince you that you need to seek out a better or easier practice. Getting annoyed with every instance of mind wandering or sleepiness is like tearing up the garden to get rid of the weeds. attempting to force attention to remain stable is like trying to make a sapling grow taller by stretching it. Chasing after physical pliancy and meditative joy is like prying open a bud so it will blossom more quickly. Impatience and striving won't make anything grow faster. Be patient and trust in the process. Care for the mind like a skilled gardener, and everything will flower and fruit in due time. First Interlude. Conscious Experience and the Objectives of Meditation. In this chapter, I introduce a basic conceptual model of conscious experience. You can consider this a map of the topography, the landscape of the mind, so to speak. The meditation instructions are like the roads allowing you to explore this landscape comfortably. However, remember that a map is only a representation, not the thing itself. When circumstances change, as your practice improves, you'll find yourself wanting a new map. This is why, in later chapters, I provide two additional, much more in-depth models of the mind for you to work from. Each map builds on the previous ones, and together they lead you toward the two major objectives of meditation practice, stable attention and mindfulness, both of which we will look at more closely in this interlude. A model of conscious experience. Consciousness consists of whatever we're experiencing in the moment. It's a lot like vision. Just as the objects in our field of vision change from one moment to the next, objects in our field of conscious awareness, like sights, sounds, smells, and other external phenomena, also arise and pass away. Of course, this field isn't just limited to what we perceive with our outer senses. It also includes internal mental objects, which come in the form of transitory thoughts, feelings, and memories. Attention and peripheral awareness. Conscious experience takes two different forms, attention and peripheral awareness. Whenever we focus our attention on something, it dominates our conscious experience. At the same time, however, we can be more generally aware of things in the background. For example, right now your attention is focused on what you're hearing. At the same time, you're also aware of other sights, sounds, smells, and sensations in the periphery. The way attention and peripheral awareness work together is a lot like the relationship between visual focus and peripheral vision. Try fixing your eyes on an external object. You will notice that as you focus on the object, your peripheral vision takes in other information elsewhere in your field of vision. You can compare that with your experience of attention and peripheral awareness in daily life, where you pay attention to some things while remaining peripherally aware of others. For instance, you may be listening intently to what a person is saying. At the same time, you're peripherally aware of the flavor of the tea you're drinking, traffic noises in the background, and the pleasant feelings of sitting in a cozy chair. Just as with vision, we're more fully conscious of the object in the focus of our attention, but we remain conscious of the many objects in peripheral awareness as well. When we shift our focus, what had been at the center of attention moves to the periphery. As attention moves from one object to another, from the conversation to the mug of tea, we become more fully conscious of each object in turn, while remaining peripherally aware of the others. It's important to realize attention and peripheral awareness are two different ways of knowing the world. Each has its virtues, as well as its shortcomings. Attention singles out some small part of the content of the field of conscious awareness from the rest in order to analyze and interpret it. On the other hand, peripheral awareness is more holistic, open, and inclusive, and provides the overall context for conscious experience. It has more to do with the relationships of objects to one another and to the whole. In this book, whenever the term awareness is used, it refers to peripheral awareness. It never means attention. The distinction between the two is key. The failure to recognize this distinction creates considerable confusion. In meditation, we work with both attention and peripheral awareness to cultivate stable attention and mindfulness. the two main practice objectives of meditation. Jump-starting your practice. Although a full understanding of attention and awareness is essential, some of you might want to get right into the practice. So here is a quick and basic version of the meditation instructions. 1. Posture. A. When you sit in a chair or on a cushion on the floor, make yourself as comfortable as possible with your back straight. B. Get your back, neck, and head in alignment, front to back and side to side. C. I recommend closed eyes to start with, but you can keep them open if you prefer. 2. Relax. A. While maintaining a straight back, release any tension in the body. B. Relax your mind. Take some moments to appreciate the fact that you're gifting yourself with time away from all the usual tasks and worries of your life. 3. Intention and breath. A. Resolve to practice diligently for the entire meditation session, no matter how it goes. B. Breathe through your nose as naturally as possible, without trying to control your breath. C. Bring your attention to the sensations associated with the breath in and around your nostrils or upper lip. Another option is to center your attention on the sensations associated with breathing in the abdomen. See which of these is the easiest for you to focus on, and then stick with that one, at least for the sit at hand. This is your meditation object. D. Allow your attention to stay centered on your meditation object while your peripheral awareness remains relaxed and open to anything that arises. For example, sounds in the environment, physical sensations in the body, thoughts in the background. E. Try to keep your attention centered on the meditation object. Inevitably, your mind will get distracted and drift away. As soon as you recognize this has happened, take a moment to appreciate the fact that you have remembered your intention to meditate and give your mind an imaginary pat on the back. The tendency is to judge yourself and feel disappointed for having lost your focus, but doing so is counterproductive. Mind wandering is natural. So it's not important that you lost your focus. Remembering and returning your focus to the meditation object is what's important. Therefore, positively reinforce such behavior by doing your best to reward the mind for remembering. F. Now, gently recenter your attention on the meditation object. G. Repeat step 3 until the meditation session is over. And remember, the only bad meditation session is the one you didn't do. The first objective of meditation, stable attention. Concentration, as a concept, is rather vague and in danger of being misinterpreted or of having meditation students bring their own preconceived ideas to it. I prefer to use the more accurate and useful term, stable attention. It's more descriptive of what we're actually trying to do in meditation. Stable attention is the ability to intentionally direct and sustain the focus of attention, as well as to control the scope of attention. Intentionally directing and sustaining attention simply means that we learn to choose which object we are going to attend to and keep our attention continuously fixed on it. Controlling the scope of attention means training the mind to adjust how wide or narrow our focus is, and being more selective and intentional about what is included and excluded. Again, as an analogy, consider how vision works. To see something in all its detail, we must hold our gaze steady for as long as necessary, while focusing neither too narrowly nor too broadly. For many, everyday life is a combination of distraction and hectic multitasking. Having focused, sustained, and selective attention is a much more peaceful and engaging way of experiencing the world. It's also the most valuable tool we have for investigating our minds and coming to understand ourselves. Let's consider in more detail how stable attention is cultivated. Spontaneous movements of attention. To develop intentionally directed, stable attention, you must first have a clear understanding of its opposite, spontaneous movements of attention. Attention moves spontaneously in three different ways: scanning, getting captured, and alternating. Scanning is when our focus moves from object to object, searching the outer world or the contents of our mind for something of interest. Getting captured happens when an object, like a thought, bodily sensation, or some external stimulus, suddenly captures our attention. An ambulance siren can take our attention away from the book we're reading, or the pain of a stubbed toe can take our attention away from pleasant thoughts while we're out for a walk. You're probably familiar with this sort of spontaneous movement of attention, as it happens all the time. The third type of spontaneous movement, alternating attention, is a subtler kind of scattered attention, only apparent to an experienced meditator. To be clear, everyone's attention alternates, whether they meditate or not. The difference is that the non-meditator doesn't experience his or her attention as alternating. Instead, there is the illusion of paying attention to two or more things simultaneously. What's actually happening is that the focus of attention is moving very quickly among several different objects, but staying with each one for about the same amount of time overall. It's the kind of attention we have when multitasking. If you're doodling in class while listening to a professor, your focus is moving so swiftly that there doesn't seem to be a break in your attention to each object. Attention to both seems simultaneous. Another way we might experience alternating attention is when our attention seems to stay focused on one object while certain things stand out from peripheral awareness. For instance, you might be answering an email, but you also hear the cat meowing to be fed and feel pressure in your bladder. Attention is still shifting rapidly among different objects, but it lingers longer on the main object, answering the email. Essentially, anything that stands out from the background of peripheral awareness does so because it is intermittently becoming an object of attention. In all these examples, we experience a continuity of attention, but attention is shifting rapidly among different objects. Unless you're purposely multitasking, alternating attention is a kind of spontaneous movement of attention. That means a certain amount of distraction is present. During meditation, intentional movements of attention will eventually replace all three types of spontaneous movements of attention. This process unfolds gradually and systematically through the stages. Let's look at what it means to intentionally direct and sustain attention, and how to control the scope of attention. Intentionally directing and sustaining attention. Intentionally directed attention means just that. We make a conscious decision about what to pay attention to. When we're at work, we have to purposely shift our focus from one thing to the next to finish a job. Also, when we get distracted and lose our focus, we have to intentionally bring ourselves back to the job. Beginning in the very first stages, 2 and 3, you exercise and strengthen your ability to intentionally direct attention. But that's only half the work. After directing your attention to the breath, you'll soon find that your mind has wandered off. For this reason, you also have to learn how to sustain attention. This means you want to stop all spontaneous movements of attention. Now, sustaining attention is trickier than directing attention. Why? It's possible to voluntarily direct attention. However, the part of the mind that sustains attention for more than a few moments works entirely unconsciously. We can't use our will to control how long we remain focused on one thing. Instead, an unconscious process weighs the importance of what we're focusing on against other possible objects of attention. If an object is important or interesting enough, attention remains stable. If something else is judged more important or interesting, then the balance tips and attention moves elsewhere. Even though this weighing process isn't under our conscious control, we can still influence it through consciously held intentions. Just by intending to observe an object and to come back whenever we get distracted, we're training that unconscious process to help us stay focused more continuously. It's a lot like learning to throw darts. The complex motor skills you need for dart throwing also involve training an unconscious process for using intention and repetition. By holding the intention to hit the target as you throw the darts, you train unconscious and involuntary hand-eye coordination until you can consistently hit the target. Any information held in consciousness is communicated to the unconscious. Formulating the conscious intention to focus on the meditation object provides a new piece of information for unconscious processes to take into account. Holding this intention, together with returning our attention to the breath over and over whenever we get distracted, informs the unconscious weighing process that keeping the focus on the breath is important. You start throwing mental darts at the target of sustained attention in stage 2. By stage 4, you have developed a consistent ability to keep your attention on the meditation object. Attention feels continuous and stable at stage 4, but the focus of attention still alternates rapidly between the meditation object and distractions, which we experience as objects that stand out from peripheral awareness. In order to truly master directed and sustained attention, we have to overcome this tendency for attention to alternate. Exclusive attention to one object, also called single-pointedness, is very different from alternating attention. Exclusive attention doesn't move back and forth between distractions and our intended focus. In stages 1 through 5, you greatly improve your overall stability of attention, but you only achieve exclusive attention in stage 6. We've just described how conscious intention influences the unconscious mechanisms that sustain attention, but that's only the beginning. Throughout the stages, you use conscious intention to train the unconscious mind in a variety of ways. The correct use of intention can also transform bad habits, undo incorrect views, and cultivate healthier perspectives. In short, skillfully applying conscious intention can completely restructure the mind and transform who we are. This is the very essence of meditation. We reprogram unconscious mental processes by repeating basic tasks over and over with a clear intention. We'll talk more about how this simple activity changes unconscious processes when we introduce the mind system model in the 5th interlude. Scope of attention. Once you can direct and sustain your attention, you will then work on controlling the scope of attention, how wide or narrow you want your focus to be. Many tasks in daily life require us to expand or contract our focus of attention. When threading a needle or straining to hear somebody talk in a noisy room, we really have to focus in and pay attention to detail. When watching football, our attention might start on the quarterback, but as soon as he gets the ball, the scope of our attention expands, taking in all the action on the field. Although we do have some control, without training, our scope tends to change automatically due to unconscious influences. An expanded scope is a lot like alternating attention, in that you can include more things in attention. It, too, can be a useful tool for multitasking. Yet when we're trying to have stable attention, a scope that keeps spontaneously expanding will let in all kinds of distractions. Attention won't really be stable until you can intentionally determine the scope of your focus and keep it steady. This is a skill you cultivate mainly in stage 6. After your focus of attention has become more stable, you learn to control the scope through a series of exercises where you deliberately shift between a narrow and a broad focus. In both stages 6 and 7, you give particular emphasis to exclusive focus on the meditation object. By stage 8, you have mastered control of your scope and can broaden your focus so it includes the entire field of conscious awareness in a single, open and expansive non-focus. Ordinarily, having so broad a focus would just mean being dimly aware of many things at once. Fortunately, we can also increase the power of consciousness, meaning everything will still be quite clear. This brings us to the second objective of meditation, mindfulness. The second objective of meditation, mindfulness. When the mindfulness of a samurai warrior fails, he loses his life. When we lack mindfulness in daily life, something similar happens. We become so entangled in our own thoughts and emotions that we forget the bigger picture. Our perspective narrows and we lose our way. We do and say regretful things that cause needless suffering to ourselves and others. Mindfulness allows us to recognize our options, choose our responses wisely, and take control over the direction of our lives. It also gives us the power to change our past conditioning and become the person we want to be. Most importantly, mindfulness leads to insight, wisdom, and awakening. But what is mindfulness? Mindfulness is a somewhat unfortunate translation of the Pali word sati, because it suggests being attentive or remembering to pay attention. This doesn't really capture the full meaning and importance of sati. Even without sati, we're always paying attention to something. But with sati, we pay attention to the right things, and in a more skillful way. This is because having sati actually means that you're more fully conscious and alert than normal. As a result, our peripheral awareness is much stronger, and our attention is used with unprecedented precision and objectivity. A more accurate but clumsy-sounding phrase would be powerfully effective conscious awareness, or fully conscious awareness. I use the word mindfulness because people are familiar with it. However, by mindfulness, I specifically mean the optimal interaction between attention and peripheral awareness, which requires increasing the overall conscious power of the mind. Let's unpack this definition. Normal functions of attention and peripheral awareness. To really grasp mindfulness, we first have to know what attention and peripheral awareness normally do. Each has a different function, and they provide two distinct kinds of information, but they also work together. And to respond intelligently to our environment, we need both. With this understanding, you will see how ordinary attention and awareness can become that optimal interaction we call mindfulness. Attention has a very specific job. It picks out one object from the general field of conscious awareness, then analyzes and interprets that object. It's the faculty of attention that helps us discern between conflicting pieces of information. For example, is that a snake in the road or just a piece of rope? Once an object of attention has been identified and analyzed, it can be further examined, reflected on, judged, and responded to. In order for this process to happen quickly and effectively, attention turns all of its objects into concepts or abstract ideas, unless, of course, the object is already a concept or idea. Generally, attention translates our raw experience of the world into terms we can more easily understand, which we then organize into a picture of reality. Peripheral awareness, on the other hand, works very differently. Instead of singling out one object for analysis, it involves a general awareness of everything our senses take in. Peripheral awareness is only minimally conceptual. It is open and inclusive, as well as holistic. That is, it's concerned with the relationships of objects to each other and to the whole. Peripheral awareness allows us to respond more effectively by giving us information about the background and context of our experience, where we are, what's happening around us, what we're doing, and why. For example, not mistaking the rope for a snake, since we're in Alaska, and it's winter. Attention analyzes our experience, and peripheral awareness provides the context. When one or the other doesn't do its job, or when there isn't enough interaction between the two, then we respond to situations less effectively. We may overreact, make poor decisions, or misinterpret what's going on. Any new sensation, thought, or feeling appears first in peripheral awareness. It is here that the mind decides whether or not something is important enough to become an object of attention. Peripheral awareness filters out unimportant information and captures the objects that deserve closer scrutiny by attention. This is why specific objects can seem to pop out of peripheral awareness to become the objects of attention. Attention will also browse the objects in peripheral awareness, searching for something relevant or important, or just more entertaining, to examine. This is the scanning process we described earlier. But what we do with attention trains peripheral awareness to select certain things as well. If you're interested in birds, for example, peripheral awareness learns to keep watch for flying feathered objects. As attention hones in on something, peripheral awareness is alert and on the lookout for anything new or unusual. When awareness takes in something that might be of interest, it frees attention from its current object and redirects it toward the new object. Say you're engrossed in a conversation while walking, when out of the corner of your eye you notice a shape moving toward you. Peripheral awareness alerts attention, which quickly processes the information. We're in the bike lane, and a biker is heading straight for us. So you grab your friend and step out of the way. Peripheral awareness helps us stay alert to our surroundings and to use attention as effectively as possible. When peripheral awareness doesn't do its job, attention moves blindly, without guidance, and can be taken off guard. Fortunately, not every experience needs to be analyzed. Otherwise, attention would be quite overwhelmed. Peripheral awareness takes care of many things without invoking attention, such as brushing a fly away from your face while you're eating lunch. Attention can certainly be involved with brushing the fly away, as well as with other small things, like choosing what to eat next on your plate. But there are simply too many basic tasks that don't require attention. Using it for all of them would be impossible. There are also situations that happen too fast for attention to deal with. For instance, attention can't provide the quick, reflexive response of a mother who stops her child from running into a busy street. Because peripheral awareness doesn't process information as thoroughly as attention, it responds much more quickly. If peripheral awareness doesn't do its job, attention is too easily overwhelmed and too slow to take over these functions. As a result, we don't react to these events at all, or we react to them in a completely unconscious and automatic way, blindly, mindlessly, and with none of the benefits of conscious processing. Another way attention and awareness work together is by helping us see things more objectively. On its own, attention usually involves a strong concern for self. This makes sense, considering that part of attention's job is to evaluate the importance of things in terms of our personal well-being. But it also means that objects of attention can be easily distorted by desire, fear, aversion, and other emotions. Attention not only interprets objects based on self-interest, it leads us to identify with external objects. This is my car, or mental states. I am angry, happy, etc. Peripheral awareness is less personal and takes things in more objectively, as they are. External objects, feeling states, and mental activities, rather than being identified with, appear in peripheral awareness as part of a bigger picture. We may be peripherally aware, for example, that some annoyance is arising. This is very different from having the thought, I am annoyed. Strong peripheral awareness helps tone down the self-centered tendencies of attention, making perception more objective. But when peripheral awareness fades, the way we perceive things becomes self-centered and distorted. Finally, attention and peripheral awareness can be either extrospective or introspective. Extrospective means that attention or awareness is directed toward objects that come from outside your mind, such as sights, smells, or bodily sensations. Introspective means the objects in consciousness are internal, thoughts, feelings, states, and activities of mind. Even though attention and awareness can be either extrospective or introspective, only peripheral awareness can observe the overall state of mind. For example, whether it is happy, peaceful, or agitated, as well as the activities of the mind. For example, whether attention is moving or not, and whether attention is occupied with thinking, remembering, or listening. The condition in which the mind stands back to observe its own state and activities is called metacognitive introspective awareness. Attention, on the other hand, can't observe activities of the mind because its movements and abstracting of information from awareness are activities of the mind. In other words, we can't attend to attention. When attention is focused on remembering, for example, you can't also use attention to know you're remembering, but you can be aware that you're remembering. Also, because attention works by isolating objects, it cannot observe overall states of the mind. If you do turn your attention introspectively, it takes a snapshot from peripheral awareness of your mental state right before you looked. Say someone asks, "How do you feel?" When you look inside, attention tries to transform awareness of your overall mental state into a specific conceptual thought, like, "I am happy." Now that we've seen how different yet interdependent attention and peripheral awareness are, the importance of having both is obvious. We are responding to something in almost every waking moment, whether it comes from the environment or from within our own mind. Those responses include not just our words and actions, but the thoughts and emotions we experience as well. Although it may not seem like it, there is always more than one way we can respond, which means there's a continuous process of decision-making going on as well. The quality of these moment-to-moment decisions depends on the quality of the information made available by both attention and awareness. Everything we think, feel, say, or do from one moment to the next, who we are, and how we behave, all ultimately depends on the interactions between attention and awareness. Mindfulness is the optimum interaction between the two, so cultivating mindfulness can change everything we think, feel, say, and do for the better. It can completely transform who we are. Comparison of peripheral awareness and attention. Peripheral awareness: holistic, relational, contextual. Attention: isolates and analyzes. Peripheral awareness: filters all incoming information. Attention: selects information from awareness. Peripheral awareness: acts as a watchful alert system. Attention: hones in on objects. Peripheral awareness: less processing, quicker response. Attention: more processing, slower response. Peripheral awareness: less personal and more objective. Attention: more self-centered. Peripheral awareness can be introspective and extrospective. Attention can be introspective or extrospective. Cultivating mindfulness. Why aren't we naturally more mindful? Why does mindfulness have to be cultivated? There are two main reasons. First, most of us have never really learned to use peripheral awareness effectively. Second, we don't have enough conscious power to sustain mindfulness, especially at the times when we need it most. The first of these two problems I describe as awareness deficit disorder. This means a chronic lack of awareness due to overusing attention. Most people overuse attention because it's under direct conscious control and peripheral awareness isn't. Awareness arises automatically in response to external or internal stimuli, so it's easy to neglect. Consistently neglecting peripheral awareness in favor of attention eventually stunts the faculty of awareness. In meditation, where other distractions are minimized, we can learn to use peripheral awareness effectively and become skilled at using attention and awareness together. However, skill at using attention and awareness is only one part of mindfulness training. Developing raw mental power is the other part that often gets overlooked. Without this increase in power, you won't get very far in cultivating mindfulness, and you will still find yourself losing mindfulness when you need it most, especially off the cushion. For example, if your partner had a bad day at work and complains about the food you made, it takes mindfulness to maintain an objective awareness that recognizes the real cause of the complaint. But when strong emotions take hold, All your energy pours into hyper-focused attention as you go into fight-or-flight mode. Your awareness fails, and attention hones in on the criticism as a personal attack. Sustained mindfulness requires a consciousness that's more powerful than normal. Think of consciousness as a limited power source. Both attention and awareness draw their energy from this shared source. With only a limited amount of energy available for both, there will always be a trade-off between the two. When attention focuses intensely on an object, the field of conscious awareness begins to contract, and peripheral awareness of the background fades. Intensify that focus enough, and the context and guidance provided by peripheral awareness disappears completely. In this state, awareness can no longer ensure that attention is directed to where it's most necessary and beneficial. This is like wearing blinders or having tunnel vision. We simply don't have enough conscious power to continue to be aware of our surroundings while focusing so intently on the object. This is always a problem in situations where attention drains our conscious capacity, such as during an argument, dealing with an urgent problem, or when falling in love. There are other ways we can lose mindfulness, but they all come down to not having enough conscious power to sustain an optimal interaction between attention and awareness. It takes considerable conscious power to attend to many different objects, so we lose awareness. Thus, we lose mindfulness whenever our attention shifts rapidly back and forth between different objects, such as when multitasking. Emotional stress causes the same thing to happen. We have so many worries and concerns competing for attention that we lose perspective. And, of course, dullness also robs us of the conscious power necessary for mindfulness. On the other hand, when we're in a relaxed state, awareness tends to open, and the intensity of attention dissipates. Relax even more, and attention increasingly fades. More often than not, dullness sets in. Because attention and awareness draw from the same limited capacity for consciousness, when one grows brighter, the other becomes dimmer, resulting in suboptimal performance and loss of mindfulness. Proper training in mindfulness changes this equation, providing more conscious power for optimal interaction and no more trade-offs. The goal, therefore, is to increase the total power of consciousness available for both attention and awareness. The result is peripheral awareness that is clearer and attention that gets used more appropriately, purposefully, in the present moment and without becoming bogged down in judgment and projection. Increasing the power of mindfulness. Increasing the power of consciousness isn't a mysterious process. It's a lot like weight training. You simply do exercises where you practice sustaining close attention and strong peripheral awareness at the same time. This is the only way to make consciousness more powerful. The more vivid you can make your attention while sustaining awareness, the more power you will gain. You will learn a number of different exercises as you move through the stages. In the higher stages of meditation, attention and awareness actually merge together to become one fully integrated system. More about that in the chapter on Stage 8. Like strengthening a muscle, developing powerful mindfulness involves enhancing a natural capacity we all have. Just reflect for a moment on how your alertness and clarity of mind change throughout the day. Sometimes we feel quite sharp, energetic, and lucid. A life-threatening situation is an exceptional example of this. Time slows down. We become finely attuned to every little detail. Every color, shape, sound, and sensation is vivid. Sometimes we have the feeling of being an outside observer, just watching the events unfold. Athletes refer to this kind of hyper-conscious state as being in the zone. This is one extreme. On the other end of the spectrum, there are times during the day when we feel sluggish. A lack of mental energy leads to dullness and then to drowsiness. In these kinds of states, we miss much of what's happening around us and often misinterpret what we are able to perceive. Severe fatigue or alcohol can cause extreme dullness. Deep sleep is the ultimate state of dullness. These varying experiences show the range of the conscious capabilities of our mind. Compare your normal level of consciousness with that of an athlete in the zone or with a person in an emergency. You'll realize that daily life consists mostly of different degrees of dullness and mindlessness. As you progress through each stage in this practice, you move steadily away from dullness toward enhanced states of consciousness that support increased mindfulness. Having more conscious power means the quality of both attention and peripheral awareness improves. This transforms the interaction between them in a number of important ways. Peripheral awareness doesn't fade when attention is very focused. Peripheral awareness does a better job of providing context and makes you more sensitive to how objects relate to each other and to the whole. Peripheral awareness processes information more thoroughly, making it better at selecting appropriate objects for attention to focus on. Attention is always directed toward the most important objects. Attention becomes clearer, more intense, and can analyze things more effectively. Because peripheral awareness is more powerful, attention doesn't get stuck in subjectivity and projection. Perception is more objective and has more of the seeing things as they are quality of awareness. How mindfulness progresses through the 10 stages. Throughout the stages of meditation, you systematically train your attention and peripheral awareness in order to develop mindfulness. This is a matter of both skill development and increasing the total power of consciousness. As you progress, I will introduce new techniques and guidance in each stage to help you more fully develop both skill in mindfulness and power of consciousness. This training starts in stage 3. You practice focusing more and more closely on the meditation object while sustaining extrospective awareness. In stages 4 through 6, as the clarity and stability of attention improve dramatically, the emphasis will be on developing strong introspective awareness. At stage 5, you specifically aim to increase the power of consciousness by trying to detect very subtle sensations without losing awareness. In stage 6, you further increase conscious power by dramatically expanding the scope of your intention to include the entire body, while still trying to detect very subtle sensations. By the end of stage 6, your attention is extremely stable, and you have perfected metacognitive introspective awareness, the ability to continuously observe the state and activity of the mind. In stage 7, you practice narrowing the scope way down, honing in on the constantly changing details of sensations, bringing the power of consciousness to its fullest development by stage 8. The benefits of mindfulness. When you have cultivated mindfulness, life becomes richer, more vivid, more satisfying, and you don't take everything that happens so personally. Attention plays a more appropriate role within the greater context of a broad and powerful awareness. You're fully present, happier, and at ease, because you're not so easily caught up in the stories and melodramas the mind likes to concoct. Your powers of attention are used more appropriately and effectively to examine the world. You become more objective and clear-headed and develop an enhanced awareness of the whole. When all these factors are ripe, you're ready for profound insight into the true nature of reality. These are the extraordinary benefits of mindfulness. Summary. The two main objectives of meditation practice are developing stable attention, cultivating powerful mindfulness that optimizes the interaction between attention and awareness. A famous analogy in Zen compares the mind to a pool of water. This is a helpful way to think about the training and goals of meditation. If the water is agitated, churned up by wind and currents, it doesn't provide a clear reflection, nor can we see to the bottom. But as the water calms, the debris that made the pool muddy begins to settle, and the water itself becomes clear. A calm pool also reflects the sky and clouds perfectly. In the same way, if the mind is agitated, disturbed by the concerns of daily life, it doesn't accurately reflect experience. Instead, we are caught up in projections and lack perspective. The inner workings of the mind remain murky as well, full of mental debris that clutter our thinking. Developing stable attention is the key to making the water calm, settled, and pure. Mindfulness is like the sunlight that illuminates the surface as well as the depths. Don't forget, however, that the path is as important as the goal. The stages outlined in this book may bring you to a state of peace and insight, but they are also an exciting journey of discovery into the nature of the mind. Relish in this beautiful and sometimes challenging journey. The goal isn't just getting to a calm, quiet pool, but learning about the makeup of the water itself as it goes from choppy to still, from cloudy to crystal clear. Stage 1. Establishing a practice. 1. The goal for Stage 1 is to develop a regular meditation practice. Put all your effort into forming and holding a conscious intention to sit down and meditate for a set period every day, and to practice diligently for the duration of the sit. When your intentions are clear and strong, the appropriate actions naturally follow, and you'll find yourself regularly sitting down to meditate. If this doesn't happen, rather than chastising yourself and trying to force yourself to practice, work on strengthening your motivation and intentions instead. Practice goals for Stage 1. There are two goals for Stage 1. First, you will learn how to prepare for practice and to use a simple method to enter meditation gradually. Second, and more important, is to establish a consistent daily practice where you meditate to the best of your ability throughout every session. To succeed, you'll need to recognize the obstacles that stand in your way and create solutions. Mastering this stage provides you with the strong foundation you need to progress rapidly through the 10 stages. How to begin your practice. The basic practice used in this book is quite simple. Direct your attention toward a well-defined meditation object. Whenever your attention slips, redirect it back to that object. Repeat this as often as needed. Rather than jump right in, though, you'll start with two preliminary practices to help prepare your body and mind for a smooth transition to the meditation object. 6-point preparation for meditation. I recommend the following 6-point preparation to new students. You should prepare for meditation just as you would for other activities, by thinking and planning beforehand. Memorize these 6 points and go through them as soon as you sit down. You can even review them in your head while on the way to your meditation spot. They are motivation, goals, expectations, diligence, distractions, and posture. 1. Fire up your motivation. After you sit down, the first thing to do is to remind yourself why you've chosen to meditate. Perhaps it's to have a little more peace of mind and improve your mental skills. Or it could be to achieve awakening. Or maybe it's just because you know you'll feel better for the rest of the day if you meditate than if you don't. Don't judge your reasons as being good or bad. Just acknowledge and accept them as they are. Having a clear sense of purpose will fire up your motivation and help you deal with any feelings of restlessness or resistance. 2. Set reasonable goals. Goals give direction, and it's important they be realistic so you're not disappointed. Ask yourself what you hope to accomplish in this particular session. Think about the problems you've been working on in recent sits, and decide how you can best apply yourself to the practice today. Then choose a goal for this sit that's reasonable, given your recent progress. At first, your goals can be simple, such as not giving up and daydreaming, or remaining patient when your mind wanders or you get drowsy. Understanding the stages and which one you're at is a powerful tool for setting realistic goals, so periodically revisit the overview. 3. Beware of expectations. You should set goals and practice diligently to achieve them, but be careful of ambitious expectations about where you should be. You can easily set yourself up for disappointment. Resolve to hold the goals you've set very lightly, to find enjoyment in every meditation, no matter what happens, and to savor any achievement. Simply sitting down to practice is an accomplishment. There will be sessions where it's easy to focus. This is the fruit of your previous practice, but don't expect to notice obvious progress each time you sit. There will be plateaus where nothing seems to change for days or weeks. Today you may have less stability of attention or mindfulness than you did weeks or even months ago. That's normal, so stay relaxed. Make your effort diligent yet joyful. Don't get caught up in expectations. And always remember, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. 4. Commit to diligence. Diligence means engaging wholeheartedly in the practice rather than spending your time on the cushion, planning, or daydreaming. You will be tempted to think about things that are more interesting or important than the meditation object. Problems to be solved, projects to plan, and fantasies to entertain. So commit not to indulge in these tempting distractions. Also, judging the quality of your practice can lead to doubt, giving rise to procrastination and resistance. Remind yourself that whenever resistance arises, the best way to overcome it is by simply continuing to practice. Resolve to practice diligently for the entire session, regardless of how your meditation goes. 5. Review potential distractions. It's important to know your state of mind before you begin to meditate. Perform a quick inventory of the things in your life that could come up as distractions, such as a problem at work or an argument with a friend. Check to see if your mind is occupied by any worries about the future, regrets about the past, doubts, or other annoyances. It will help to review the 5 hindrances described in the second interlude. Acknowledge these thoughts and emotions, whatever they are, and resolve to set them aside if they arise. You may not be wholly successful, but just setting the intention will make them easier to handle. 6. Adjust your posture. Before you begin, review your posture and get comfortable. Here's a checklist. Adjust any supports you use to help you sit comfortably. Your head, neck, and back should be aligned, leaning neither forward nor backward nor to the side. Your shoulders should be even and your hands level with each other so your muscles are balanced. Your lips should be closed, your teeth slightly apart, and your tongue against the roof of your mouth, with the tip against the back of your upper teeth. Start with your eyes closed and angled slightly downward, as though you were reading a book. This creates the least tension in your forehead and face. If you prefer, leave your eyes slightly open, with your gaze directed at the floor in front of you. Your eyes will move during meditation, but when you notice they've shifted, return them to where they were. With your lips closed, breathe through your nose in a natural way. It shouldn't feel controlled or forced. Relax and enjoy yourself. Scan your body for any tension and let it go. All the activity of meditation is in the mind, so the body should be like a lump of soft clay, solid and stable, but completely pliant. This helps keep physical distractions to a minimum. For more on how to sit, refer to The Right Posture later in this chapter. Sometimes new students say, "I seem to spend a lot of time just doing the preparation for practice. Is that a problem?" When I ask how the rest of their meditation went afterward, that usually answers the question. By the time you go through the 6 points, your mind will be well settled. The preparation also helps establish a consistent practice, free from resistance and the deliberate wasting of time. And it doesn't matter how long you spend on the preparation, because it, too, is a form of meditation, in which you still intentionally direct and sustain attention. If your mind wanders, bring it back using the same techniques we describe in the next section on breath meditation. After doing the preparation every day for a while, it will go much more quickly. Preparation for meditation. Motivation. Review your purpose for meditation. Be honest. Don't judge your reasons. Be aware and accept them. Example: I want more peace of mind. Goals. Decide what you hope to work out in this session. Set a reasonable goal for where you are in the stages. Keep it simple. Keep it small. Example: not to get annoyed when my mind wanders. Expectations. Bring to mind the dangers of expectations and be gentle with yourself. Find enjoyment in every meditation, no matter what happens. There is no such thing as a bad meditation. Diligence. Resolve to practice diligently for the entire session. Recall that the best way to overcome resistance is by simply continuing to practice without judging yourself. Distractions. Perform a quick inventory of things in your life that might come up to distract you. Acknowledge these thoughts and emotions, and resolve to set them aside if they do arise. You may not be wholly successful, but at least you have planted a seed, the intention not to let them dominate your mind. Posture. Review your posture and get comfortable. Attend to your supports, your head, neck, back, shoulders, lips, eyes, and breath. Relax and enjoy yourself. All the activity of meditation is in the mind, so the proper state for the body is like a lump of soft clay, solid and stable, but completely pliant. This will keep physical distractions to a minimum. The meditation object. A meditation object is something you intentionally choose to be the focus of your attention during meditation. Although you can choose just about anything, the breath is ideal for cultivating attention and mindfulness. First, the breath is always with you. Second, it allows you to be a completely passive observer. You don't need to do anything, such as repeat a mantra, generate a visualization, or rely on any special item like a candle, icon, or kasina. You can meditate on the breath at any opportunity, wherever you are, every day, even up to your dying breath. The breath also changes over time, becoming fainter as concentration deepens. This makes it suitable for developing powerful attention, since the details you focus on become ever more subtle as sensations grow less distinct. Likewise, the fact that sensations change continuously, moment by moment, is conducive to insight into the nature of impermanence. Yet the breath also constantly repeats itself over and over in the same pattern, making it suitable as a fixed, that is, relatively unchanging, meditation object.